thank you all for coming today. Let's go ahead and get started. It's a pleasure to see everybody for this first of this spring's meetings of the Russia Health Working Group. And it is a great pleasure to be able to introduce my friend Cindy Buckley, who is the chair of the Department of Slavic and Eurasian Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She is, without a doubt, the best-known, most-respected authority on a whole host of health and social issues in Central Asia and in the Caucasus, and will be talking with us today about a relatively new research project that she's embarking on. And I'll just get it wrong, so maybe I'll let her tell you the details, but it's lots and lots of money from the federal government to study things that are near and dear to all of our hearts. So we are very very pleased that this kind of funding is moving in that direction. And I know most of us know one another because we get together reasonably frequently every year, but I would like to introduce two special guests who are joining us today, if they don't mind me doing that. Olga Miller is here from the Renova Corporation in New York, and Marina Dobrynina is here from Moscow and New York. She's the president of the Dobry Vek Foundation in Moscow and New York. So thank you both for being with us today. We very much appreciate it. So without further ado, I'll introduce Cindy. Okay, you have the floor.
All right. Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here today. I think I finally appreciate for you guys it's a pleasure to be anywhere today. And while perhaps, perhaps just the joy of getting out, I was amazed and quite pleased to find the sidewalk shoveled and buildings visible, but congratulations on making it through Snowzilla, I think is what we really need to call it. But it's really a pleasure today to come and talk a little bit about what, as Judy pointed out, is a new research project that focuses on the emergence of the Eurasian migration system. And I'll talk a little bit more about the specifics as we move on, but what I'm going to focus on today is just a little piece of it, because to get a boatload of money, you got to make it a big project. And lest you have another 10-day sojourn in the same room, I think I'll just focus on the links between migration and health and how they're influencing policy right now in the Russian Federation. As someone who's lived in Texas now for not quite, but coming dangerously close to two decades, migration obviously is something that I see every day. And so one of the things that has really become very, very clear in this work, even in these initial stages, is how similar the processes are between Russia's reaction to large-scale in-migration and the reaction in the United States as well. And I think that one of the things that we need to focus on, perhaps as opposed to our historical focus on Russian exceptionalism, is really integrating the Russian case into discussions of international migration, discussions of social tolerance, and discussions of the links between the process of migration and overall public health, as well as the development of individual health and health behaviors. So because I have a tendency to alliterate when under pressure, the title is Borders, Biases, and Biothreats, International Migration and Health in the Russian Federation. And as everyone in the room knows, we're really dealing with worlds in motion right now, globally. Migration is quite high. Many argue, like Saskia Sassen, that it's always been high. It's just that it's interesting to write about now, or that we know a little bit more about it. But there is rising attention to migration across the globe, and this is a consistent concern, whether it's Western Europe, whether it's Mexico, who is struggling with their own in-migration problems from Central America, whether it's Texas, which is kind of an interesting case since I believe that border shifted. It's hard to know who the migrant is in that case, or whether we're looking at the rise of the Minutemen and more vigilante activity in Arizona as well as in Krasnodar. We are dealing with a globe that is continuously vexed by migration. At this point as well, particularly with the new neo-colonial migration of primarily Muslim migrants into Western Europe, we're also really reevaluating the limits of assimilation and the desire for integration, whether that be social or economic. And so while where you thought we were moving on to this multicultural Svetli Budushi, we're definitely looking at something a little bit more problematic at this point in time. And we have a continued inability, and this is globally. Meeting with demographers who study migration is hysterical because we all sit around and talk about how little we know. A rarity among academics, mind you, but still something that really makes one humble. We have a horrible inability to measure or control immigration effectively. And whether we're thinking about how we are going to count or not count migrants in the next census, whether that census be in the Russian Federation or here in the United States, or whether how we cling to this myth of migration control and move our analyses, as Doug Massey pointed out over a decade ago, beyond the smoke and mirrors of migration policy to actually understanding how state regulations interact with individual desires and perceptions of opportunity. So, and Russia is a destination state, a major destination state, according to the newest estimates, the major destination state for international migration in the global economy. This is a picture from the last census in 2002 that just shows the percent foreign-born, the people who are born outside of the Russian Federation as of 2002. These, of course, as every person who works with the census will tell you, are the people who got counted and were born outside of the Russian Federation.
Excuse me for a sec, Cindy. The screen isn't showing what Cindy's laptop screen
oh my gosh.
Is currently showing. There we go.
Yay! Thanks, Judy. I'm sorry about that.
Glad you're on top of things.
And, you know, you guys have snow blindness, evidently. Okay, I'll keep that in mind. So Russia is a major... You've really been inside too long. I'm so sorry. Pardon? Or not long enough. All right. So Russia is a major destination state. I sure can. So, and as we think about migration... We also need to think about health, and migration and health linkages are well known, and they're certainly something that a lot of American demographers – is that enough? Can you hear? A lot of American demographers have worked on long and hard in terms of looking at the Hispanic health paradox in the United States, wherein migrants who have clear disadvantage in the job market, who have lower levels of human capital and lower levels of financial capital, nonetheless have better health outcomes than the native-born. There are many reasons for this. One is migrant selectivity. The healthy don't migrate. They have a tendency to stay at home, and so you're getting the best of the best. At that point, however, there's still a question. Is it simply that we're getting the healthiest people from origin countries, so perhaps the healthiest Tajiks, or is it indeed that we're getting in migrants who are very...
I'm sorry. Unhealthy people.
Unhealthy, yeah, I'm sorry. Isn't that what I said? I apologize. Unhealthy migrants are a rarity. So migrant selectivity would tell us that migrants actually have better health because they are positively selected for good health. Increasing evidence in the United States and Western Europe shows that migrants typically have better cultural protection for positive health outcomes as well, stronger ties to family, and stronger social support networks, stronger social barriers to excessive drinking or smoking, more physical activity as opposed to what many have talked about in the United States is the Twinkie hypothesis. The longer you are here and the more Twinkies you will eat, the more your health profile will look like an American. Migrants not eating Twinkies do better with beans and rice, have a more natural diet, and often because of a combination of cultural factors as well as economic aspects of the labor market position they hold, it have much more physical activity, and therefore they maintain better health throughout the life course. This is countered, however, by increasing evidence of environmental risks. Migrants across the globe always get the 3D jobs. They're dangerous, they're dirty, and they're typically demeaning. because they have those 3D jobs, and that is their niche in all the global labor markets in the developed world, we find that oftentimes environmental risks mean that with increasing duration, so the longer someone is a migrant, the worse their health will become. So they start off with an advantage, they lose that advantage very quickly, and the trajectory over, say, a 10-year time horizon will put them at a health disadvantage vis-a-vis the native-born population. There's an increasing amount of work coming out of France right now talking about the causes of the effect of cumulative disadvantage. And this is the idea that, yes, when you first get here, your cultural protection and your positive selectivity will hold you in good health status, but you are economically disadvantaged, and that over time, the cumulative effects of that economic disadvantage will manifest itself in very negative health behaviors. Colleagues of mine at the NGO Tajikistan in Moscow are doing now, just setting up a longitudinal study to look at health of Tajik labor migrants over duration. This is a prospective study. The anecdotal evidence shows very clearly that after, say, 8 to 10 years, especially in the construction industry, most of the migrants have suffered some sort of major bodily trauma. And so aside from just the repetition of heavy physical labor, the accident rates, which are very high, typically in those dangerous, dirty, and demeaning jobs, is also something to be of concern. Do you have a question?
It's clear as this regards adults.
Yeah.
But when they have babies and children, do those children get the same level of medical care as the indigenous population, or are they more at risk?
The short answer is no. And the longer answer is, I'll talk a little bit about second generation. So we call them, these are the migrants. These are people who were born abroad and come in typically to work. Second generation, actually what we find in the United States, and we certainly find in France, we don't need to remember what's gone on in the suburbs of Paris. Second generation, oftentimes, most sociologists argue, are extremely disadvantaged because of the cumulative disadvantage. The fact that they know that no matter how hard they work, they will not break out of that immigrant niche, and therefore their health behaviors are actually worse than the native-born. That's also true for school attendance and academic achievement. And again, we still are in the beginning processes of collecting data on this in Russia. There are some excellent sociologists at the Institute of Sociology in Moscow that are setting up a study to look at second generation. And I have a paper coming out in a month that looks at the second generation folks from the Gender and Generation Survey. So that's a great question. There's also negative assimilation. And I think these two photos of colleagues of mine, I hate to play to the stereotype, because alcohol consumption actually, if you look at the survey data, has declined, especially among the youth in Russia. But at the bottom, you see what used to be in the early 90s a pretty common sight coming up out of the metro station and someone enjoying the breakfast of champions. I live in Texas. It's not that rare. And up at the top is a dear friend of mine who I've actually written and published about, a Armenian migrant who was working on a collective farm as the construction brigade, surprise, surprise, and he was the samagon maker in the village, the best samagon maker, let's put it this way. Many tried, few succeeded. And he was the best. You didn't really, the other stuff he was very good if you ever needed to take off nail polish, but you didn't really want to drink it. So the idea here about negative assimilation does go back into this idea of the Twinkie hypothesis, this idea that you move in and you pick up the bad health habits. So you drink more, you smoke more. But also remember, you're under intense social pressure. You're away from monitoring networks, social networks that would tell you don't do that. And so there are many studies that talk about negative assimilation, particularly for young men. And here we get into the gender analysis as well, because most studies globally, whether they are in Southeast Asia or some really interesting work that's now just being started in Georgia, we find that women have a tendency to avoid negative assimilation much more readily than men. And I think I could say something very sarcastic, so I'm going to go to the next slide. Okay. Oh, I'll save it for the end. Okay. So as Judy was so kind to point out, I'm really grateful to NSF and the Department of Defense for funding our People, Power, and Conflict in the Eurasian Migration System study, and that's the larger project that this comes from. And in addition, I wanted to point out that I have three excellent PIs on this, Blair Rubel, who many of you know well, Beth Michnick, and Tim Heleniak, who I believe spoke to this group before, and we're also ably assisted by Aaron Hoffman and Elizabeth Malinkin. And what we're trying to do is bring in the Russian case, largely. Two basic questions. What can the theories and methods of international migration help add to our understanding of what's going on in Russia? Really come at this with the experience that other countries have been destination states. How has this worked? What are some of the things we should look for? But more importantly, what can the Russian case, in its unique sort of quasi-post-colonial, multicultural, multi-ethnic, multilinguistic setting, what can the Russian case add to our understanding of how migration operates? And so I think this is a really important way to look at it, and again, kind of getting away from Russian exceptionalism. What can we generalize from Russian exceptionalism? Russia is one of the destination states, and Eurasia is an increasingly important migration system. We ignore it to our peril, and the newest volume that was just published 13 months ago of Castles and Miller's seminal work on international migration talks about the North American system, the Western European system, the Southeast Asian system, the Gulf State system, and says there's a lot of migration in Russia too. And so we really need to kind of expand and widen our scope. So I'm going to try and do four things kind of quickly and then maybe open it up for discussion, and then I'll tell my obnoxious joke. The first one is to discuss the ways in which constructed and real borders, sorry about that, Alexandra knows my computer died this morning, so I rewrote this morning, influence migration trends, to look at the origins and outcomes of anti-migrant biases, to look at the ways in which migration has been redesigned as a bio-threat to really make migrants much more scary than they would be otherwise, and to evaluate the influence of fact and fiction on migration policy generation. So the first thing is regional issues and borders. Where are Russia's borders? That can start a very long and contentious debate, I think, with almost anyone in the region in terms of where Russia's borders are, but they are particularly poignant in terms of migration. First, I think we need to think about regional issues and borders in terms of federalism. To what extent does Russia have the ability to set its migration policy from the central government? And to what extent do regional governors, specifically those in the Far East and in southern regions such as Krasnodar, what leeway do they have in terms of circumventing central control or changing specific labor market quotas? Preliminary evidence from our project shows that actually regional leaders have a lot of leeway, not unlike the situation in the United States, where states can decide a lot of things that influence migrant integration, whether it's getting a driver's license or having access to health care. In Russia, what we find is that regional leaders in places like Orenburg have been much more lax in terms of migrant assimilation, labor market permits, residency permits, and opening up schools across the oblast to migrant children without question. Sort of a new take on don't ask, don't tell. When children show up, they are registered, they are not asked for their citizenship papers, so to speak, or their parents' citizenship papers. This is an interesting issue. Most of our analyses of federalism have really focused on financial aspects. But here we have a very concrete issue in which local governments have clear interest in trying to dictate how law is interpreted and enforced. But interestingly enough, again, we haven't had a lot of political scientists delving into this as a problem of federalism. And there's plenty of room for everybody, so the invitation's open. The second element is the way in which borders really are different with the presence of co-ethnics. This is particularly true in the Southern Caucasus and Northern Caucasus, where you have huge family ties, regional ties, that cut across borders. Also in terms of Armenia in particular, there are 6 oblasts in the Russian Federation that if you go into the Minister of Labor's office in Yerevan, he has a map of Yerevan, and then there are 6 colored in oblasts in Russia, which he also considers the Armenian labor market. This surprised none of my colleagues in Moscow, but I think it really helps us understand that the presence of co-ethnics in different regions across the country really influence this migration situation. We know that the labor market varies dramatically. We also know security perceptions vary dramatically. And this is most important, perhaps, in the Far East. This is one part of the puzzle that we're leaving for the next big grant. But Michael Alexeyev and others have been looking at increasing Chinese migration. And again, there we have a clear example of local inability to enact what are centrally federal laws trying to restrict in migration. But more importantly, public opinion differs dramatically. In a 2008 survey done by the Levada Center, it was amazing to find that the standard deviation on migrant tolerance was higher than the standard deviation on income. It means that there was more variation across Russia's regions in terms of how people felt about migrants than there were about income. Anyone who's been to Russia recently knows that income varies a lot. and so that's usually quite one of the biggest variations that we find. But public opinion overall has shown huge ebbs and flows over time. Not surprisingly, some of the most reluctant opinion surveys in terms of not wanting increased migration or feeling that migrants were a threat come from the two largest cities, Moscow and St. Petersburg, where perceptions are extraordinarily negative, particularly in terms of Tajiki. Not surprisingly, Orenburg is one of the more tolerant regions, perhaps because of the local government, perhaps because the government is reflecting the will of the residents. It's hard to say. But Orenburg, Kurgan seem very, very tolerant. Major metropolitan areas, much less so. Again, very similar to what you find in the United States. And so when we think about these border issues, I think we need to think about real and imagined communities. The map has changed. The history has changed, and the newspapers have changed. So the imagined communities have changed as well. But for many migrant streams, particularly those originating in the Southern Caucasus, there is still an imagined community of the post-Soviet space. And this is exemplified by the fact that 4 countries, with the exception of Georgia, of the CIS, you can go into Russia without a visa. You don't have a work permit. And there are problems with getting a work permit. But the fact that there is visa-free travel tells us again that maybe the borders aren't really where the national borders are. And it makes kind of theorizing about migration a little bit more challenging. To me, this is a really clear situation that we find in the American Southwest as well, where Mexico stops and the United States starts is still, for people who live in the border and live along the colonias, is still a debatable question. There is certainly a line you can find with a GIS indicator, or a GPS indicator, but it's not going to really tell you how people live their lives. And so many people, when they say, "Are you an international migrant?" they say, "No. I'm from Tajikistan. How could I be an international migrant? I'm here in Moscow." And so this only further complicates the way in which we think about measuring and tracking migration. So borders are contentious, but biases are also quite prevalent. Anti-migrant sentiment is rising. This is true globally, according to a recent survey by the Pew Charitable Trust. Lines of demarcation that are raised particularly as the Levada Center has done with a meta overview of 142 recent public opinion surveys over the past 6 years that had questions about migrants. These were the four issues that rose to the top in terms of concerns of the native-born. Migrants use social services, so they're a strain on the budget. They are to blame for long lines at hospitals. They are to blame for large class sizes in elementary schools. National identity threats. They don't speak our language. They don't go to the Orthodox Church. They don't look like us, and they're not trying to. Tax evasion, right? They're working off the books. They are making it impossible for Russia to actually document its economic activities, which leads to some questions about the composition of the economy. But more importantly, because they're working off the books, they're not paying taxes. And lastly, religious orientations. There is increasingly, and I would almost argue this might be the French reaction, after the riots in the suburbs of Paris, you started to see an uptick in Russia in terms of the people answering surveys that they were concerned because migrants were adherents of Islam and that this was somehow problematic. My question, however, is this a global or a local trend? Is Russia somehow unique? Certainly its history and its situation in terms of having the near abroad once as, little brothers, right, in the Soviet House of Nationalities. But it's also quite global. Again, if you go to the Pew Charitable Trust and you look over the last 10 years, these are precisely the four issues that come to the top in terms of American concerns about immigration as well. So there's clearly a lot of shared interest.
You don't mention assuming jobs that locals might.
It's,
it certainly does occur in this country.
Yeah. The economic stuff, often in these, the way the opinion polls are working, it's not the idea. There's some question as to how it gets worded. Because if you were just going to give it open-ended and ask someone, I think it would be labor market-based. But I think when you give them a list and the job stuff is, you know, they take jobs away from similarly qualified locals, it gets a little watered down. So it's an excellent point. Yes, sir.
Is there a difference in the regions with under the regional governor's authorities for immigrants that is varies differently from the federal level?
Well, there's a difference in how they're interpreting law. None of the regional governors have the right to pass different laws for the say the quota of work permits under the new system. They can, however, petition the center to get higher work permits, and those petitions seemingly have never been rejected. So they have a little bit of leeway. Where they have more leeway, at least this is what our fieldwork in Krasnodar has shown, they have much more leeway in terms of their instructions to local police forces, their instructions to local school systems, their instructions to local public hospitals. And that in that is where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, in terms of actual differences in lived experiences for migrants in some place like St. Petersburg versus some place like Orenburg. Okay. So what's interesting is that I think we find that across the globe, political leaders seeing public uneasiness with immigration have really resorted to what we want is our kind of migrants. We want the good migrants. And you can certainly find probably a similar quote from, I would argue, a similar quote from every member of the U.S. Congress, particularly those from my state, saying something similar to this. Migrant policy, our priority is to attract compatriots, code word for ethnic Russians, from abroad. In this regard, we need to encourage skilled migrants to our country, educated, law-abiding people to come to Russia. People coming to our country must treat our culture and national traditions with respect. Absolutely nothing surprising about this. This is a statement you can find. You can go to any political rally. I tried to get one from Kay Bailey in the last governor's debate, but I haven't been able to get the transcripts yet, and I couldn't type fast enough. But We want our kind of migrants. Certainly not a surprising sentiment, but what the code here is, and this is not unique to Russia at all, but this is a very clear example, the code is we want a certain kind of migrant, and evidently they're not getting that kind of migrant. So we must not be getting our compatriots, we must not be getting the skilled migrants, and we're not getting the educated and the law-abiding to come to Russia. And so the message here is quite clear. It's not unique. I think globally you find the same thing. But I think the message to the populace is really quite clear.
The Irish are coming. Just to kind of check on this point.
And as a second generation Irish immigrant.
Go ahead.
Please.
You know, politicians say we want our kind of migrant.
Mm-hmm.
But, really our kind of migrant is someone who's going to mow the lawn and clean the toilet and do the 3D jobs. So there's a lot of kind of have your cake and eat it too. Here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think this is really typified, and I'd be more than happy to hear from anyone with more insight on this. I think it's really crystallized by the comparison between Lushkov and that statement from Putin. Lushkov knows that if he could get those work permits and he can pay those Tajik migrants very, very little money, he would have a pristine city. And he did it. I'm from the place where we have the wall. Mm-hmm. Anybody want to guess who built it? Well, we don't know, and we say unregistered. Yeah. Everybody's illegal. I'm sorry. I have to watch myself too. So, no, it's exactly it, and it is this doublespeak that becomes then somewhat dangerous because you're inciting public opinion on the one hand, but you're also denying an economic reality.
What you really want for this is the video footage of last year's demonstration by Dvizhenie protiv nezakonnoy migratsii, where the Tajiks came in and cleaned up after the march.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Do you have any feel for what happens in the case where foreign corporations build a factory in a particular location in a region and have a need for this new facility that didn't exist before to hire labor?
Mm-hmm.
Is there just a bureaucratic process, or does it involve a lot of other things that are uncomfortable?
In joint ventures, particularly in Western Siberia, if they're foreign funded, and even some of the local funding, many of the new production facilities, although there aren't as many as in the rest of the world due to the economic downturn, you're seeing a better class of job come online. And so these factories are cleaner, they're more high tech, and the jobs pay better. This isn't the migrant labor market. And so what you do see, however, is for example, there are several joint agricultural interests in Novosibirsk and the surrounding regions. They are very interested in bringing in seasonal migrants and have applied and received labor permits under the new system. Russia gave out approved 1.8 million labor permits in 2008 and ended up giving out 2.1 million. So there is quite a lot of leverage. I'm sure that they're, like everything else, it's a brokering situation and it's got to cost some political capital one way or the other, but it does seem as if that's one way in which they're able to do this. And this is actually quite clever because if they set the number of labor permits a little bit lower, it's much more palatable for the central powers, and then they make the individual governors stand up and say, I want more, so that if there is any problem, it's on the head of the governors.
Sorry, just a clarification. How are those permits distributed across the regions?
They're allocated by request and by economic
estimations for the number of migrants that are required.
Based on the size of the economy or the size of the population?
Based on the unemployment rate, the size and composition of the economy, there is a higher preference given to agricultural labor because they know they need the seasonal work permits. And then they do that in coordination with the administrators from the federal districts. Okay. So we talked about migration and health. In this time of increasing migration, as well as increasing uncomfortableness, both politically and socially, about migration, migrants as a health threat has also begun to emerge. And perhaps the clearest example was in 2007 when the Minister of Health comes out to say 1 in 10 migrant workers suffers from infectious diseases such as HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, or hepatitis. I believe in the United...
How would that be different from the broader Russian
population? that is higher. Excellent question. Just one second. And I would say at the same time in the United States, remember, this was the wall debate, and migrants were bringing in the plague. Right? So it's the same sort of thing. I do have that clip, but I didn't bring it. I got it from The Daily Show. All right. But it's not just... political officials in the Russian central government as well. I think international organizations have also played a role in this. It's easy to use migrants as a scapegoat. Multi-drug resistant tuberculosis is driven by migrants coming into Russia.
After they imprison them.
This is, and here's an interesting methodological point. This was said at an open forum at the East European and Eurasians AIDS conference in October of last year. And when I got up to quote him on it, and I said, well, can I have your name? Can I attribute that to you? Because you did say it in front of 200 people. And he said, no, don't, you can't quote me on that. So I'll just say he's a WHO official. but this is really playing to the argument, right? The idea that it is migrants.
Russian WHO official. Yeah.
Okay. Let's just say there's a Yale public health degree there. Okay. So, in addition, even though these numbers are minuscule, particularly given that Zhanna Janskovskaya and her working team, their most recent estimate of the number of unregistered migrants in Russia overall goes between 4.5 and 7 million, right? That's a lot. What we have, and there are lots and lots of press reports about this, is of CIS migrants, we've had 187 deported due to HIV. Not B, sorry about that, and 864 deported for other health issues. So out of somewhere between 4.5 and 7 million, there's been, you know, a little over 1,000 deported for health concerns. HIV in particular, I think, is something to be aware of. The current agreement in the CIS right now, and they have a codicil with Georgia as well, is that if you are tested for HIV and you come up HIV positive, you will be deported to the country of citizenship. This is and the next words are on humanitarian grounds. The reason for this is that all of them have signed on to an agreement to provide without cost ARV treatment to citizens who are HIV positive, and therefore on humanitarian grounds you will be deported. Sent back to your home country. So migrants are evil. They are bringing in disease. Not only are they bringing in infectious disease, but there is increasing concern about migrants coming in who are not fully vaccinated. There's something to be said for this, particularly with the collapse of the vital registration system and the vaccination system in Tajikistan. Less than 60% of infants are getting their basic immunizations in Tajikistan.
Sorry, are you talking about vaccination for
measles, polio, the basic up to 36 months? Only 60% they estimate right now, according to the multi-cluster indicator survey from UNICEF, 60% of Tajik infants, again, under three. That's not our migration age group. That might be a problem in another decade or so, but it's pakarana to say that, that's going to be a concern right now. Well, that's a great question. Most of the immunization, the official statistics for immunizations are still quite high, usually well above 92%. I know that two men had the lowest 20 years ago, and that was 92%. But I'm not. I see. If I was Murray, I would have that all memorized, but I don't. I apologize.
Yeah, it's Murray who makes me wonder whether that's a little optimistic.
I'm wondering whether some of our globally, I think some of our immunization statistics are optimistic, but we'll see. That's a great question. So then the question,
Go back on the HIV testing.
You bet.
So if you're
HIV testing, as I said in the slide. Yes.
So if an undocumented or even legally immigrant is tested positive, they have to go back. So that really doesn't encourage a lot of testing.
No, it doesn't. No. And it is counterindicated by UNAIDS guidelines. Russia is now donating to the Global Fund. The rest of the former Soviet Union, most of them are recipients, in some cases sizable recipients, of Global Fund monies. But this is an element where they haven't, to be perfectly honest, I think perhaps because the U.S. itself didn't let people in if they were HIV positive until just recently. They were not following through on this very strongly.
Is there a situation when immigrants are coming in, I have no idea whether this is yes or no, is there a situation where they are grouped together as they're being processed where if someone has a communicable disease, they expose the others to it, whereas if 100 people are waiting to be processed and are together over a long period of time, one of them can multiply the factor by 10 or 20 times and therefore really skew the statistics.
No. The sentinel testing is really clear. Since HIV testing is still voluntary, except for prison populations going into the military and some other or having a child, that what we end up doing when you say you're going to deport people who are HIV positive is that you stop people from getting tested. In terms of having the Ellis Island approach, this is not really what's been going on so far. What has been going on much more readily is the idea that Company A in Krasnodar has a contract, and they have a fixer who goes to Tajikistan, who goes to five different villages, and those guys get their tickets and get their when they get to Krasnodar, they get their paperwork, they get their stamp, and they're good to go. Now, they all know each other. Many of them travel together, and certainly the train from Moscow from Dushanbe is a breeding ground for all sorts of communicable diseases. It's pretty tightly packed, as are many of the trains between Mexico and the United States. So there's some potential there. But what I think is much more important is that there's not testing for all migrants who come across the border. We know from the healthy migrant effect that they're not going to migrate unless they feel pretty good. So you're not getting MDRT sufferers who are making the trek across the Russian border. But what you do find is that maybe for things that have long latency periods, potentially HIV, sure, you might have some migrants coming in who have some diseases that are communicable. On the flip side, is it that they are bringing it in, or as most recipient countries would argue, and this is particularly true in terms of Azerbaijan and Georgia in terms of the HIV situation, if you go to their national HIV center, they keep a running tab of how many HIV cases were migrants in Russia. And if you ever had been to Russia at any point in your time, they assume you contracted HIV when you were in Russia. And so it cuts both ways, this idea of the bio threat. Okay. But are migrants really that unhealthy? Because, again, they're maybe healthier than their origin communities, but we don't know if they're healthier than their destination communities. And so using the Russian Gender and Generation Survey in 2004, there's a new version out in 2008, but it still hasn't been cleaned yet. And my advice would be hold off for a little while after running some preliminary analyses. What this shows you is kind of a overall picture in terms of self-assessed health, chronic conditions, and we're looking at the total up top, the native-born, and the foreign-born. And basically, you know, statistically, there's no significant difference. They're pretty much similar in terms of health. Now, of course, when I found this out, I was really very, very sad because I was looking for these healthy migrants, right? And I didn't find them. Does anyone have an idea on why? This is confounded by the fact that these are all the foreign-born as of 2004, and many of them were ethnic Russians who came back with the same sort of, they did not benefit perhaps from the cultural protection. They did not have the sort of positive health behaviors that you find with other migrants. And so, not to bore you with statistics, there's multiple factors involved here. So I knew... That's a good, yeah, no, if you take enough statistics courses, you will find what you want to argue. logistic regression analyses, controlling for age, sex, education, right? So we're taking that effect out. Non-Russian speakers. If you do not speak Russian, have better health. They are twice as likely to report having good or excellent health than Russian-speaking natives. They are people who migrated into Russia from the near abroad.
Well, that's the self-assessment, right?
That's the self-assessment. It also holds for the chronic conditions and the long-term debilitating diseases.
Right.
Yeah. You could be picking up a cultural thing here, too, in terms of, you know, they sometimes in the U.S., comparisons between Anglo and Hispanics in the U.S. become complicated. When you ask a question in Spanish, nobody says they have excellent health because it sounds like you're bragging. Evidently, Anglos don't have a problem with that in English. And so there might be some of that, but I don't think it would give you log odds of 2.06 and highly significant. The native-born have 40 to 60% higher probability of having a chronic disease or a long-term disability when you control for among the non-Russian ethnics. So the migrants actually are healthier.
How much of it is alcohol consumption?
That's a great question and one that's almost impossible to answer. But there's two possibilities here. One is the salmon effect, and this has been argued in terms of migrant health in the United States, and that says that actually these migrants are infected and they're horrible and they're terrible, and they come to Russia and they get everybody sick, and then they go back to their own country because a sick migrant cannot stay at destination because they can't work. And so the idea is that you get this, the return, right? They go against the stream and return home to die. The other possibility is that health selectivity actually does play a major role here, that much more healthy people are coming in. Now, with preliminary analyses from the Russian Longitudinal Monitoring Survey, where alcohol consumption is woefully underreported, or they have a very unique sample of any population, we do find that non-ethnic Russians tend to drink less and smoke less when you take out the Baltics. Alcohol consumption among the Baltic ethnic groups is quite high.
Smoking also?
In terms of smoking, what we find is that anyone who's been in Russia more than 5 years, you lose that health protective effect. After 5 years, they smoke at similar rates to the native-born. They do not drink at or report drinking, I should say, at common links to the native-born. This is very similar to what you find in the United States with the Hispanic population. Migrants drink far less than native-born Americans.
There's another case in another discipline I won't refer to, but it gave me the idea for asking this. Do the native-born have 40 to 60% higher probability because, perhaps, the reporting individuals or institutions care more about the native-borns than they do foreigners and therefore don't really report what the foreigners
I think that's
have.
An excellent point, because to feel that you have a chronic condition, typically, you know, people just don't say, I have diabetes, unless it's been diagnosed. And it can't be diagnosed unless you have access to health care. High blood pressure, высокое давление, that's easier to claim you have whether it's been diagnosed or not. So there is it's hard to say, and I think that factors in somewhat. Absolutely. With some of the demographic and health surveys for women, you're able to control for whether they've seen a doctor in the last 12 months. And that can help get away from a lot of this. But unfortunately, gentlemen, the effects are primarily driven by men, not women. And therefore, it's, you know, that little piece of the puzzle remains kind of a black box. But it's an excellent point. Thank you for bringing it up. Okay. So it's lots of factors. We do know, however, that the health threats feed xenophobia. Sending and receiving nations are using migration and health as a cudgel to beat each other. Whether this is the Southern Caucasus claiming that their HIV cases are all from migrants who went to Russia and got unlucky, or, well, lucky and then very unlucky. We have a situation in which health is seen as something that travels with migration stream, and that health is now a palatable way of expressing anti-migrant sentiments. It's not that we don't like people who don't look like us, and it's not that we don't like people who don't share our religion, but they are a health threat. And we see this globally coming about as well. Poor medical care is the main issue. We have returning migrants who show very poor health, and this is particularly true in Tajikistan. Much of this has to do with the salmon effect. If you're still healthy, you will continue to live and work in Russia. When you become injured, you come back home. And so receiving countries are really vexed by return streams of migrants that require a lot of social service support. On the flip side, what I found quite interesting in a project that I just finished that's under review right now is that in the Southern Caucasus, families report spending a substantial amount of remittance income on health care. And this is not high-quality health care in most cases, but that remittance income is really being used to support the collapse of medical systems in sending states, whether that is Tajikistan or Armenia. While there's still an argument that you can get a multiplier effect when you spend the remittances in the realm of healthcare, the effectiveness in terms of remittances as a development tool is much less than in standard economic models where you would argue migrant families would invest that or open a business or build a new house. And so health and migration are linked another way at origin. So how does this influence theory? Russia is a great case to test health effects because, unfortunately, and although it does seem that things are improving, Russia has seen, as Judy has noted throughout her work, a fairly drastic and dramatic decline in health over the last 20 years. Given that it is, in terms of health, a very challenging situation, it's quite ironic that it's also a land of opportunity economically and comparatively for people from the near abroad. And so you have migrants coming into a context not unlike some of my European colleagues are starting to talk about in the United States, what they call a toxic health culture. And so if we're going to see migrant selectivity and if we're going to really see large migration effects in terms of positive contributions to health, it should be in Russia. They should be drinking less, smoking less, getting more exercise. In migrants should be a health revitalization for Russia. All the theory points to that. Probably not a politically palatable argument, but that's what the theory would tell us. We have really complex post-colonial issues at play here as well. And so this idea of culture and medical care and immunizations for children and health expectations are unique in Russia given the fact that the whole region shared a Soviet past, which indeed had highly differential health care across the republics, but still it had one public health care system. And so it's a natural experiment to see what happens now in terms of people from one region coming into Russia in terms of health. And I believe that looking at Russia can contribute to methodological development as well. We need to really play around with this idea of imagined communities at the border and to really think carefully about how migrants define themselves and, more importantly, how regional and local authorities elect to define migrants. For all of its fairly harsh treatment of labor migrants, Krasnodar has a very interesting approach to who is an international migrant. If you are intending to stay in Krasnodar, you are an international migrant. If you're just there to work for a couple of months, you're a guest. As long as you come from, you're not a guest if you come from Kazakhstan, but as long as you come from the Southern Caucasus, you're just a guest. And how is that going to help us understand how people conceptualize migrants and how we make migrants legible, I think could add a lot to international knowledge about migrants. And then lastly,
sorry, yeah. That I assume is kind of the official definition, right? Whether you're a guest or a migrant, depending on how long you intend to stay. But is there public perception that there is a difference, or are those people kind of seen as migrants?
Yeah, according to Russian Federation law, as of May 12th of 2008, anyone staying for longer than 30 days should be classified as a migrant or pre-migrant. The census is still going to use the international definition, which is a year. But after a month, if you're still in the Federation and you don't have residence permits and you haven't registered somewhere, you can very easily be deported. If you're a guest and on vacation, then you can't be. Now, how uniformly that law is followed, I really can't tell you, Alexandra, but it's a great question. Okay. All right. So, and then lastly, how does this influence policy? Fact or fiction? This was a game we played when we were in Moscow at the Migration and Population Center. We would find in our research trove of looking through Russian press with Jean Janskovsky's group, we would pick up the most egregious quote and say, okay, fact or fiction? And the bottom line is that both are going on right now in terms of migration discussions globally, but in Russia in particular. Fact is there are millions of migrants, most of whom are unregistered, and they will continue to come. Economic downturn or not, restrictions on work permits or not, economic opportunity drives migration. Russia has a very long border. We should, if any country should be able to understand that Russia will never be able to stop in migration, it should be the United States. So the fact is migration is occurring. It will continue to occur. It pulls along networks that were firmly established during the Soviet period and new networks that have blossomed in the time since 1991. Fiction. The idea that migrants are somehow a unique health risk or a unique health threat or harbingers of disease is, by all evidence available to us now, and that evidence is limited, fiction. This is a case in which you do not see massive numbers of people who have highly contagious infectious diseases coming over the border to work construction in St. Petersburg. We don't find that anywhere in the world. Are there potential health issues at play? Most certainly they are. But many of these stem from the economic dislocation that migrants face once they are in the Federation, similar to the economic dislocation migrants face once they arrive in the United States. Four issues in particular are contributing to this health problematic. The first has to do with substandard and very crowded living conditions. So if one goes out to Bitovsky, to the bus station outside of Moscow, you go down 2 kilometers and hang a right, you will find a Tajiki encampment. They are living in abandoned railway cars. They are cheek to jowl. It is a breeding ground for tuberculosis and anything else you can get your hands on. In terms of other illnesses or perhaps trauma in particular, studies by, again, the NGO Tajikistan have shown that well over 1,100 Tajiki migrants in the city of Moscow alone have been killed since 1995 in construction accidents. And they're very adamant that that's an underestimate. That's more than the number of all migrants for the entire CIS that have been deported for health concerns. Okay. Are migrants a health threat? Are they a bio threat? I think that is a fiction. But unfortunately, it can be a very useful fiction. And it is one that I encourage all of us to take very seriously, not only in the Russian case, but overall. Globally, when we look at migration to understand both the selectivity that is involved as well as the impact of a salmon effect where they would go against the stream to get home if they were really sick, migrants tend to improve overall health outcomes. Just as one small aside, the regional officials in Orenburg pointed out that without for second-generation migrants, so these would be migrants who are in Orenburg and their fertility, that without their contribution to the population of Orenburg, they would never qualify for any, the very, very few families in Orenburg would ever qualify for some of Putin's pronatalist policies. Right? In the state of Texas, for example, where we are number 49, thank God for Mississippi, okay, we're number 49 in terms of unwed teen births. If we did not have a very sizable Hispanic population where there is a much lower rate of unwed teen births, we'd be 50 with a, not with a bullet, I guess it'd be with a rock. Is that it? 50 with a rock. We would be well below Mississippi. And I actually think they calculated that way too. That's what they published. But at any rate, I digress. I think what we need to think about is what is fact and what is fiction in terms of what migrants contribute to the health profile of a country. All of the evidence thus far, and certainly most of the theoretical and empirical work globally, has shown us that migrants contribute dramatically to improve the health profile at destination. If there is a health cost to be experienced, it is typically experienced by migrants who either over time lose their health advantage or are subject to the repercussions of the dangerous, dirty, and demeaning work that migrants tend to do. And so I think as we move forward in this project, my colleagues and I are really going to be looking at clarifying issues of migration and place experience in comparative perspective. Russia has a uniquely challenging situation with migration and health right now. It is not the only country facing these things. And the more we work together with our colleagues here and the more carefully that we set up migration studies in the Russian Federation, I think the more we can gain globally as well as through our understanding of the Federation. So,
I think something very important, especially in the methodology of the research related to policy, is what I consider it's a fact that there's a very importance to the factor of the relationship of the immigrants to the health institution or the doctors. Mm-hmm. And there's an American historical example that I think shows this. Remember back in the 1960s, early 1970s, women weren't reporting rapes or attacks to the police because if they did, they'd have to contend with a male policeman who sometimes they said was worse in the questioning, you know, than just forgetting about it. And as a policy matter, police departments hired women officers, and the men officers, as well as the women, went through sensitivity training and so forth to be able to handle rape cases. Mm-hmm. As a result, more women reported to the police the rapes and cooperated with the police. That resulted in the FBI's rape statistics going up, and it showed that rape was doubling and just skyrocketing, and people had to explain to the media that this was more women reporting rapes, not rapes going up. Mm-hmm. Same thing with immigrants going to the hospital when they don't actually have to, with an emergency situation, avoiding it simply because something's uncomfortable or they fear going, whereas a Russian speaking citizen wouldn't have that same fear or lack of rapport with the doctor. Mm-hmm. And I think that would really influence, mm-hmm. could influence the statistics methodologically, and maybe argues for a policy in Russia and elsewhere of doing something to increase the positive rapport between potential patients and the medical institution.
Mm-hmm. And ironically, in the early 90s, there was a fairly sizable exodus of healthcare workers from Central Asia into the Russian healthcare system, because many of the Russian healthcare workers went abroad. And so not all of them were ethnic Russians. And so ironically, there are medical care providers who have at least some level of cultural affinity with some of the migrants, but yeah, they are really not going.
Except that healthcare workers in general in Russia have a fairly low, shall we say, rate of their bedside manner leaves something to be desired.
Mm-hmm.
But let me think. What I take away from your presentation is the sense that you really have to distinguish when you're talking about health issues, infectious diseases, mm-hmm. lifestyle related, and workplace. Now, you look at a construction site in Moscow, the fact that a lot of these poor Tajiks are going to come away with herniated discs, mm-hmm. crushed hands, God knows what kind of orthopedic injury or problems, assuming they survive. Then they're going to go back home, and they're going to be a burden on their families, mm-hmm. and communities. And that has absolutely nothing to do with their behavior patterns or anything they brought with them. Mm-hmm. Then you look at these other issues, which are infectious diseases and lifestyle related. And clearly, the only mechanism that's going to have any significant ameliorative impact on that will be family formation. But if you do not have immigration of both young women and young men, you do have some intermarriage in mm-hmm. parts, migrant laborers in the local population. But fundamentally, you're going to have a very large, essentially, bracero population. And the chances that they are going to have very high levels of infectious diseases and then, with passage of time, lifestyle-related diseases is kind of look at migrant populations in the Persian Gulf coming mm-hmm. in, what they take home to India and Pakistan.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. this is... Mm-hmm. What do you expect? I mean, the only yeah. thing that's going to change that is going to be family formation in the receiving country, and Russian policy clearly doesn't want that.
Although Russian policy...
Maybe at local, yeah. some local levels, and local regional levels it doesn't. At the national level, they basically don't want Tajik families moving as family units mm-hmm. to St. Petersburg.
Definitely not St. Petersburg. However, outside of Moscow, there have been attempts at taking some of the abandoned rural settlements and trying to establish viable Tajiki communities. They have not succeeded, and part of this has to do with maybe the artificial nature of the experiment itself. And the fact that it is a rural place, so it's really hard. All the men could get on a bus and go into the work site, but the women were stuck there with the kids, and there wasn't a lot of social infrastructure. However, I would say if we look at what has happened in Western Europe and we look at what has happened in the United States, when you have large-scale male labor migration and distances are not quite as great as they are, say, between Pakistan and some of the Gulf states, and there is the possibility of circumventing migration restrictions, that over time, whether it will be enough to stem demographic, to really influence demographic concerns, I don't know. But over time, we will see more wives joining their husbands. We will see more family formation taking place. We certainly see it in the United States. We certainly see it in Western Europe. And I don't think, even with the impressive disposal, impressive arsenal of policy that the Russian Federation has at its disposal, you cannot stop a stream like that. So I think that we will see in the next 10 to 20 years more families that will come and stay. And then we get to the second generation issue. So when we look forward, I would argue Russia has a lot that can be very, very useful in terms of using the international experience to predict what is likely to go on in the future with across the Federation. I think that the processes, while they are uniquely challenging in every country in which migration is a situation, are universal processes. And to appreciate the universality and to use that to your advantage in terms of looking at what's going on 10, 20 years out.
One comment, one reminder, one question of clarification, one larger question. Comment, great presentation, Cynthia, and a really fascinating project. And as a U.S. taxpayer, I'm pleased to see that the minute investment I've made to this project is... being well used.
Yeah. What's going to kill me is writing the thank you notes, but you'll get one.
consider it done. The reminder, you were going to tell us some kind of joke. The question of clarification was simply to clarify that Russia is the number two destination state in the world for migration.
No,
U.S. is number one.
U.S. is... so. The new statistic that ILO just came out with on their website, so there's two. In terms of percent foreign-born, the U.S. had always been number one, and Russia was number two. There is an estimate out there now that puts Russia as number one in terms of the percent foreign-born.
Wow.
Isn't that from
small
your article as well? Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I wasn't going to mention. Yeah, you're right. And so our population is growing because we have the second,
exactly,
third, and fourth generation migrants who have higher fertility. Whether that's going to become, how stable that estimate is, I'm not sure. In terms of gross numbers, yeah, we get more. But in terms of a percentage flow, some of the international organizations are starting to put Russia as number one. Which is quite ironic, given the fact that it doesn't appear in most of the textbooks on international migration.
Right. Larger question, and feel free to preface your answer with the joke. Are you or is anybody looking at this in the context of internal migration within the Russian Federation?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you know about how that looks?
Okay. Allegedly, and again, I think this is a really interesting question for federalism, the Propiska system was done away with, the internal residency permit system that really worked as a stopgap for a lot of internal migration. As soon as it was done away with at the federal level, it was re-implemented by cities, most notably by Mayor Lushkov, but across Russia, there popped up more difficult and vexing programs through which one had to get a residency permit. Without that permit, you could not access health care, you could not get your kids registered. It was very, very similar to the old Propiska system. That is supposed to go away. It is a non-market force on labor market mobility. And given the fact that there is not a very strong, and I don't think we're the ones to advise them, there's not a strong mortgage market or lending market in terms of getting a facile housing market set up that again, leads to better internal mobility.
So you say that is supposed to go away, that's supposed to go away with the WTO accession, or because
of... Oh, I'm sorry. There's been Duma discussions for the past 4 years, and I believe in July they set a charge to the new migration service that the internal migration or internal residency permit system was to be abolished.
That's why I like the Constitution.
Yes. And that was the court case that put it in. I think that practically that's going to be a very hard thing to do. But it's critical for a functioning labor market. And so I can certainly appreciate, I think it's a very wise decision to try and get rid of it. But at this point, internal migration, there's several different trends that are going on. We're seeing the central cities in most regions. I think we'll find in the next census that they have lost sizable elderly populations. And so what we're seeing are new edge cities, but they're a little grayer than they were in say U.S. Urban rural history. People cannot afford to live in the cities. Their best asset is their house, so they sell that, buy something cheaper in the suburbs, and live off the profit from their house sale. The flip side of urban history in the United States, where you saved up in the city and moved out to the Bethesda isn't a suburb anymore. What would be a Cabin John to get your
Germantown
to get your big house. And so I think what we'll see in terms of the age structure of cities, I think we'll see a big shift. But in terms of internal mobility, we still see a lot of people who don't want to move out of the far north, even with the resettlement program, although it has been somewhat successful. And a lot of people do not want to move out to the far east. The North Caucasus are a special, and thank you for bringing that up, because that was one of the things I wanted to talk about in terms of borders. There we see an enormous number of displaced peoples. It is very, very difficult to find accurate data on this, not unlike the U.S. is about to do next year in terms of New Orleans residents. When Russia did the census in 2002, people were attributed not to where they were on the day of the census, but their permanent residence. And to keep access to that permanent residence, that's where your residency was documented. So a week before the census, the estimated population of Chechnya was 590,000. After the census came in, it was 1.3 million. So in terms of... none of those people moved in that time. But there was a migration of records. Now, to what extent that will continue to go on, I'm not... I really don't know. I believe they're following the same attribution plan this year. So it has caused a lot of furor with local leaders in Dagestan and Ingushetia, where they have massive populations that they're not getting credit for. But it's hard to know specifically. It's a great question, though, and what I can tell you is that all of the economic studies we see coming out of the New Economics School and other places point to the fact that internal migrants work on a very different labor market than international migrants. International migrants are really in the dangerous, demeaning, and dirty jobs. Internal migration has higher levels of human capital. It's highly, highly networked, so it depends on, you got to know somebody to get the job, but there's not that idea of, you know, moving to New York and, you know, moving to Moscow and staking your claim, that you really have to have resources in place. There is increasing discussions in the New Eurasia Foundation and other NGOs about the problems that this causes for higher education, because people are not able to move to, you are, in essence, you are not getting the best students at the best institutions across the country, because the country is huge, and people, students cannot find housing and cannot survive without those family support networks. So that might be another thing that helps push them to work on internal migration.
Actually, I've got a question, but Andy wants his joke first.
Oh, you want your joke? Oh, so this thing about, well, you know, there's this, you know, the women look about the same, but the men, you know, the men are smoking and drinking and they're dying early, and this is awful, and you know, how do we get to the bottom of this? Where are the estimates of alcohol or cigarette consumption, and why is this? And again, yes, the sex differential is huge, but remember, we have a large sex differential in mortality in the U.S. as well, and we do have differentials in alcohol and cigarette consumptions. But
the question, why are the women so attractive, the men so ugly?
No, but that would be good too. So all I can say is that I was asking all of my senior Russian colleagues, who are infinitely more knowledgeable than I am, and Shanskovskaya looked at me and she said, "Who cares?" And every single woman on her staff said, "She's right. Who cares?" And so there is the point that, yeah, sorry. But, the argument being is that women, well, no, their point was a little more nuanced. Their point was that women... No, well, women who have to work, who have to take care of the family, who have to take care of children, who are taking care of family networks, don't have time to drink or smoke or run around. And that's true in Tajikistan, and that's true in downtown Moscow. And so that in actual cultural affinity, there's much more cultural affinity among women in terms of their lifestyles and their health behaviors than there would be for men. And so the argument would be that the only thing that really, really held the Soviet, you know, that's holding together this Soviet identity is patriarchy.
Wow. Yeah, but it's basically the same, you know, attitude toward, for example, people who are HIV positive, that since they are, their illness is a result of what we would consider to be immoral and self-destructive behavior, the sooner they die, the better. I mean, this is, heard this from members mm-hmm. of the state, too.
Yeah, but...
The only trouble is that Congress is that...
Yeah,
is
that and Congress.
Being blasé about a significant part of your population being self-destructive is not real good for the long-term health of the nation.
No. Well, and I cannot stress enough, I mean, these are very serious, brilliant people, and their personal aside on this, it's like, you know, well, why are you worried about that? Worry about me. It's not so much the people who die we have to worry about; it's the ones who are still around and taking care of things that we have to worry about. I would say, and yeah, again, I can't, being from the great state of Texas, I can't agree with Harley's comment enough. There are people in Congress now who say this. I can give you their home address, as a matter of fact. At any rate. Yeah, or at least the alleged one. At any rate, I think what I would encourage us to also look at is to move beyond this focus on only looking at behavioral decisions, because what seems to be gaining ground in many epidemiological studies about male mortality in Europe, I think has something to say about what's going on in Russia as well. And that is not so much that you're drinking or you're smoking, it's what you're doing at the same time you're doing those things. So if you're drinking and driving, we know that that's going to be a problem. If you're drinking and operating heavy machinery, also not a good combination. If you're smoking and you live in an environmentally questionable area, all of the epidemiological studies from coal mining regions in the United States point to the fact that there is a multiplicative effect. And we haven't really gone much past that. It's really easy to say, oh, it's smoking and drinking. And, yeah, some of it is smoking and drinking, just like the American health crisis has to do with the fact that we have too many remote controls. But that's not it. And I think that we need to look deeper, and I would really, I'm going to shamelessly appropriate, although cite, your very clear division of this idea of looking at infectious diseases in one, as one element, look at lifestyle choices in another, and look at work-related factors in another. I would add two more. I would look at environmental issues, and then I would also look at psychological stress levels, because that is one element that I think has been underappreciated. And it does even come back, it's not very funny, but it comes back into the male-female differential as well. Women are living longer, but their stress levels are through the roof. And so what does that mean as time goes on? And where does our concern, as people who are interested in the health of the region, need to be focused?
Self-medicating.
Yeah, what are the coping mechanisms?
Can you say anything at all about Russia as a sending country?
Yeah, that's a great...
I've got an article coming out in upcoming issue of next issue of Post-Soviet Affairs with a former student. We called it Migration Between Russia and China. And our estimate is that sometime in the next 2 or 3 years, the number of Russians living in China will be greater than the number of Chinese living in Russia.
Wow.
Probably the next 2 or 3.
Wow.
It's also and the relative human capital exchange is that the Russians are losing the educated people and they're getting the low-wage workers.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if you've seen anything broader about the numbers, because that would also have an impact on this data about Russia becoming the number one non-foreign-born.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, because, again, Russia is also a significant sending country, and Harley's work on this has been exemplary. The sending stream from Russia has declined substantially in the past few years in terms of sending into Western Europe and North America. Russians are model migrants in the North American case. If you look at migrants from the former Soviet Union and those from the Russian Federation in particular, you will find that they have higher levels of income than similarly educated migrants from other countries, even other European countries. The whole lifestyle problem then becomes somewhat curious, because in a different context, those same skills make them a model minority. In terms of the Russian-Chinese case, I have read a little bit about this, and I really look forward to reading your article when it comes out. I think that as Russia continues to develop and continues to have remarkable levels of higher education, even though there are some problems with the system, they have a remarkable level of access to higher education and incredible human capital. And so we may well see that they will become the new global entrepreneurs. China is an easy place to start. And it's, to me, very interesting what the political dynamics are that are at play, because I can't imagine the Chinese government feeling that they could put any restrictions on Russians coming in, given the number of Chinese that are moving up north in the Far East. And it must be a fascinating sort of thing. But would you tell me more? I would imagine that most of these Russian immigrants into China have to be focusing on trade and business. Is that right?
I'll send you the article. But it's multiple streams, as you'd expect.
Uh-huh.
A lot of professionals. Chinese are desperate for faculty for their expanding higher education system. It's a lot of families in the Far East sending daughters especially, but children in general, just to learn Chinese.
Yeah.
Most of them don't learn Chinese, but they stay. It's also the hospitality workers who are still in serious demand. And you mentioned the graying of the suburbs. Along the Amur, there's a graying, not a graying, but the Russians can sell their apartment in Heche, in Blagoveshchensk, move across to Heche, and it costs half as much, and they live on the difference. And there are whole globs of high rises going up to accommodate people who want to do that.
Just anecdotally, Harley, do you see the series of articles by Josh Kucera on this topic?
Good. Yeah.
Because he was anecdotally, he's kind of confirming the argument that you're making.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just, basically kind of boils down to that China is a more attractive and easier place to live for a Russian migrant than vice versa.
Absolutely.
And the numbers from China going to Russia have always been significantly exaggerated.
Is there a special case or exception in the farming areas where Russian myth, whether it's a myth or not, that the Chinese farmers are coming over the border and slowly farming Russian areas?
Misha has a little bit about that in an article, Michael Alexeyev at San Diego State University, but I have to say I haven't seen much. What I have gotten, I was just with the vice rector of the university in Vladivostok was just in Austin, and his argument was, as Harley had mentioned as well, that the migration stream was overestimated, that many of these Chinese were actually second, third, fourth, et cetera, generation residents who had, long since kind of integrated into local culture.
A lot of the agricultural work is seasonal, that comes over day for a fixed kind of period, 3-6 months, something like that.
Our experience is that, in fact, there's a huge perception and fear. And the numbers, in fact, are pretty
exaggerated.
Okay. And we did a study on that as well and found out the reality.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there have always been a significant number of Mongolian, Chinese, Koreans in various parts of Russia, the former Soviet Union, has nothing new about.
Wow.
In fact, Russia's benefited from that. That's what most of their trade with South Korea is based on, is the fact that they have ethnics who actually speak the language.
Right.
One of the greatest advertisements for Russia, I thought, this week is the Olympics, the Japanese ice skater.
Yeah.
To train with Mexico, but became a citizen.
Yep.
I want to get a couple questions in. As chair, I have a right to ask a couple questions. Two questions. One is, I'm wondering if you can talk about the pattern of migration, whether it's, a Tajik who goes to Moscow, stays and works until he can't work anymore and goes back, or whether it's a back-and-forth pattern. And I ask that in the context of wondering about the health impact of that. I think, I spent a few weeks in Lesotho back in October, where Lesotho clearly has the highest HIV prevalence rate in the world because of the number of Basotho men who went to South Africa to work in the mines but then came back seasonally and brought the HIV back with them and infected their wives, who then went on to infect others. Do you see the potential for that, or the actuality of that kind of pattern taking place between migrants coming into Russia and their points of origin? Second question has to do with differentiation between the different migrant groups in Russia. In the United States, we think about Hispanic immigrants very differently than we think about Asian immigrants, than we think about immigrants from other parts of the world. Can you talk about the level of differentiation in Russia?
That's great. Those are both terrific questions. And in terms of the cyclical nature of migration, because of the new labor permit laws and because of a focus on the Russian state of making migration more legible, both of which are perfectly understandable, border crossings, and again, this is anecdotal, but border crossings, particularly for Tajiks, is argued, are much more difficult than they had been earlier. When border crossings become difficult, people stay longer. Doesn't do anything in terms of how many people come. It's completely and totally useless in terms of that, but it will make duration increase. In Azerbaijan, where the border's still fairly open, you do get much more of the cyclical experience. And as Judy had kindly mentioned, I'd worked on HIV issues in the Southern Caucasus for UNAIDS, and certainly migrant wives did appear in the numbers much more frequently than other wives. And this is part of a book that's coming out with the Social Science Research Council and UNESCO in a couple of weeks about the gender element here, because really it does transfer the risk onto women. What I think would be fascinating, and we'll see if Prokofsky will sign off on it, but given technology now, the best HIV tests can actually tell with fairly clear accuracy the timing of infection. And so if we're able to set this up, we could actually find out, is it that the migrants are coming in with disease, or is it what we all suspect, given that prevalence rates are higher, that they're coming into Russia, they're getting diseases and bringing it back. Now, if you look in, and I think the only other two people in the world who would look in these journals are sitting at this table, thankfully, but if you look at the proceedings of the regional syphilis conferences over the past 20 years in the Southern Caucasus. I'll let you borrow mine. That's fine. If you look at the results from this, this has been a long-term trend in Soviet times as well. Shabashniki, Otrotniki, the regional worker brigades, there were always stories about the fact that this was bringing syphilis and gonorrhea back in. The director of the AIDS Center in Georgia has done some really interesting work looking at HIV typing and trying to map it out to see where different strains were coming in and trying to link that to migration. But again, it's needle in a haystack work. At the same time, though, it's perfect, because the bottom line is, if everywhere else in the world migration from low prevalence to high prevalence regions by lots of men has a tendency to spur HIV transmission, why would we not expect it to do a similar thing there? And in terms of different migration groups, thanks a million, because Alexandra knows, because she unfortunately called my hotel. My computer went this morning, and I had to retype all the PowerPoints, and I was really quite nervous and full of typos. But I missed a slide about the different migration groups, and I think that this is important to keep in mind. I think politically, clearly, Georgians are a unique group at this point, and there is a lot of multi-layered ambiguity in terms of their targeting, but it is a tough situation for Georgian migrants who are not registered. On the flip side, the Tajiki, by all surveys and by self-reports of migrants of other nationalities, really do seem to occupy the most difficult position in terms of the highest stigmatization and negative cultural attributions. This may change as more migrants from Uzbekistan come in, because that migration flow seems to be increasing. There are two differences that I think are really important. One, if migration groups had a resident diaspora with high human capital, they're better off. So the Armenians are much better off. There are plenty of Armenian doctors and professors, and they are actively protecting the Armenian migrants. And so there's something to be said for that. The Tajik diaspora, very small in number, although very powerful. And they built this NGO, Tajikistan, from nothing. And it's a really impressive situation. But there was not that deeply entrenched Tajiki elite with a network in Russia. And so, again, that puts them at a huge disadvantage. And then in terms of different migrant groups, interestingly enough, I think this is really going to start to change as the sex composition of the migration stream changes. Right now, the labor market opportunities really do strongly orient towards men. There are very few labor market opportunities for women. To the extent that they do exist, they're typically in Western Europe, so they're going to other destinations. As the Russian economy stabilizes and continues to grow, we'll probably see much more opportunity for women migrants, either working as healthcare workers or elder care or if, well, who knows, maybe the fraternal loop policy will work, nannies, that it will, that will definitely influence, I think, the relative status. We saw that happen in the U.S. With migration as well. So for right now, I think my big thing was if they had a strong integrated diaspora beforehand, they're much better off. If they didn't, they're at risk.
Do all the diasporas actually serve as support groups? Because that's not always the case with diasporas, which is why, of course, you have a Jewish population in Texas. But that was a diaspora group
yeah.
that didn't support the immigration.
Well, my colleagues argue, and I'm reluctant to say this just because I haven't done enough on-the-ground research on it, but everything that they say does seem to come through in the preliminary data. This is a charge often leveled by others towards the Azeris, that the Azerbaijani diaspora actually works much more in terms of what many have charged the Chinese diaspora in the U.S. of, which is much, once they get a toehold, then they bring in more migrants, but it's an exploitative situation where it's more of a migration industry as opposed to a support sector. To the extent, I understand why people make that argument. I feel that I would want to do a little more research before I would back that, yeah.
I can see on the second of the three B's on your title slide, biases.
Yeah.
And on here is anecdotally that there are from time to time tensions between Rus Russians and the native Russians, native minorities in Russia itself. Uh-huh. Do the terms of those, if that's true, to the extent that it's true, do the terms of those bear any relationship to the Russians' view towards those who migrate from outside the borders of Russia?
That's a great question, and I would hesitate to even forward. I will say that in terms of internal migration, we do see that minority ethnic groups with their own regions have a tendency to stay there, and indeed over the past 19 years have moved back in. So the Tatar, for example, have gone back to Tatarstan. So whether that's a reflection of nationalism and republic pride or better economic opportunities or just family linkages and family networks, I don't know. Yeah. And Saha as well, that you've gotten more people going back, which on the one hand shows that maybe these are viable national entities with strong identities. On the flip side, you could argue that's the balkanization of Russia. I'm not really sure, but I would be very reluctant just because I haven't really focused on this. I do think, given the recent political shifting in Tatarstan, it will be very interesting to see how this all plays out. Because certainly Russia has a very large Muslim minority of its own.
And set apart from all of the others. So
all right, Andy, last question.
The Tajiks have been singled out because of the large numbers or because of or particular cultural reasons. There are lots of different national Muslim groups that are coming in there. What is so special about the Tajiks?
As a proportion of the sending country population, the out-migration has been massive. Much of that has to do with the fact that there are just not any economic opportunities in Tajikistan.
Sorry,
in
Tajikistan's population?
Yeah, yeah.
It's relatively small.
Yeah, compared to Russia or Uzbekistan or even Azerbaijan, for that matter. But so it's a high proportion of Tajiks, but my second point would be I would argue we focus on the Tajiki because they are visible. They are cleaning the streets in Moscow, and you see them on the streets, and they are picking up after the yes, they are picking up after the ultra-nationalist demonstrations, and so you actually see them. We don't see many of the other migration streams that tend to be more hidden. And because Tajiki were not really incorporated very quickly into the industrial labor market, where you go into a factory, the doors are shut, and you're not seen, if you're working outside, if you're working on a construction site, they were more visible. And to me, I think that may play a role. That might not be the only reason, but to me, that does seem to be one of the reasons. Because with highly networked migration streams where people are pulled in and kept off the street, you just don't see them.
All right, we have reached past 4 o'clock, so okay. I will call this session to a close. Thank you for a fabulous presentation, which obviously sparked a lot of great questions in the discussion. Thank you all for coming, and stay tuned for an announcement of our next session.